Do you feel continually let down by modern media? Do you miss the good old days, back when all that mattered was a good story and not some agenda? Do you have ambitions of picking up a pen and pad and fighting the creative war yourself? Then this is the podcast for you. Each week, I'm going to talk to a creator who said enough is enough and started making the content they wished was out there. Join us as we discuss the ups and downs of the self-publishing world. We want to help empower you to join the Iron Age of media. Welcome to Iron Age Marketing. Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of Iron Age Marketing. I am Nikki P. here, as always. My guest today is Mr. Brian Bao. I'm assuming that's how you pronounce it. How off am I?
It's pronounced Baugh, actually. It's
okay.
German last name, yeah.
Okay. So why don't we start out, for people who don't know who you are, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Well, I am the creator of the comic book series Wolf and Batsy. It's the continuing adventures of a ferocious werewolf and a cute female vampire who are wandering the earth, searching for a place to call home. But everywhere they go, they end up eating people and getting run out of town. It's not easy to be a monster. So that's the thing I'm mostly known for. By day, I work as a storyboard artist in TV animation. And by night, I draw horror comics.
All right. I'm curious. So I get excited when I get to talk about people. And full disclosure, I'm a big fan of Wolf and Batsy. So that's why Brian is here, folks. What got you down the horror path? Like, it's not a path for everybody. It's about the niches of niche markets. So I'm always kind of curious about that thing that turns anyone down that way.
Well, it's funny. I honestly don't remember a time when I wasn't interested in monsters.
Always a creepy guy.
it just goes so far back into my childhood. I don't even remember anything else as far as a main interest. It's almost like, I almost want to say it's not that I chose horror. It's almost like horror chose me because it's always been there. The story I always tell is when I was a little kid, my dad would be watching the old black and white monster movies on TV or Godzilla or whatever, King Kong, Wolfman, Frankenstein, all the good old ones. And, he'd say, come on, watch this with me, you know, and I'd just out of curiosity watch it with him. And he would be really good about explaining, you know, how they did the Wolfman. It's just a guy with makeup on his face. You know how they made King Kong? It's just a little animated puppet. And then he even bought me like books that had like the behind the scenes secrets with pictures of the movie and pictures of the guys working the King Kong puppet or pictures of Jack Pierce putting the Wolfman makeup on Lon Chaney Jr., things like that, you know. So from a very early age, I had a fascination with monsters and also an understanding of the difference between fantasy and reality. So it never scared me. I understood it was pretend. So it never felt morally wrong to me or scary or anything I had to, I don't know, it was cool.
Well, I always tell people, it's like there's nothing on earth that scares me. Other than like going insane, like that terrifies me. that line between reality and fiction actually starting to blur is the thing that like makes me get weirded out. I'm like, ooh,
yeah, sure,
right on. And I'm curious, was your dad, obviously if that's where you got exposed, was he a horror movie kind of guy, or is it just, you know, that's the thing that sticks with you from childhood?
Well, he was a movie fan, I think. He's an interesting character because he's a businessman type. He was a computer programmer in the early 80s before computers were everywhere, you know. He worked on the military base and not the kind of person I normally would think of as a monster movie fan, but he just liked movies. And when I took to the monster movies and being a little kid, I suppose he said, you know, let's watch more of those, you know? So it was something we kind of bonded over. And, you know, well into like junior high, like if a big horror movie came out, whether it was Nightmare on Elm Street or Fright Night or whatever, he'd say, let's go see that one, you know? And so me and my dad So I saw a lot of those great 80s horror movies in the theater with my dad, because he'd just say, let's go see the latest cool one that came out, you know.
It's funny you mention Fright Night, because my actual first exposure to Fright Night was in a comic book. It was some adaptation that they did. It was like a back vignette in some comic I was reading. And I'm like, oh, that looks kind of cool. And I later found out that it was a movie. it's just always the whole thing always interests me. It's like what people find interesting. Is there a particular type of horror that really fascinated you? Obviously, your style is, you know, more like the 50s, 60s style comic. Is that by default because that's just what you draw, or is that an intentional thing because of what you love?
I don't know. I love all horror movies pretty much. Well, let's put it this way. I love pretty much all horror movies made before 1995 or six. And after that, it starts to get a little bit more, I'm a little more picky. But all the stuff from all the old black and white ones, even the silent ones from the 20s, the 1930s and 40s, classic Universal monster movies, the 1950s, when they started getting a little more sci-fi, from the tail end of the 50s, well into the 70s, you had the whole European horror movie explosion with Hammer films coming out of England. You had the Spanish horror films. The Italian Gothic horror films were huge in the 60s. That's a whole subcategory that I've gotten really obsessed with in the past several years, because there's been a lot of these Blu-ray companies that have come out, like boutique Blu-ray companies that release all these really obscure, weird foreign horror films, many of which weren't even available in the video store when I was a kid growing up in the 80s, you know? So it's been an opportunity to see a lot of those, and there's so many hidden treasures in that whole subgenre of the European horror films. So I've become very obsessed with those over the past decade or so. But then, of course, I was a kid of the 80s, right? I was like 10 in 1982, you know, the year of Creepshow and Friday the 13th Part 3. And so, yeah, it was a great year for movies. So I got to grow up as a teenager all through the whole slasher movie era, and with, again, video stores booming at that time. And we had some really great little hole-in-the-wall video stores in my hometown where they had the weird stuff, too. So I could get my Fangoria magazine and look up the really obscure movies and get those. So
I know for me, I was too young for a lot of that. Movie stores, I think, went out when I was in college, basically. But like, there was still like one or two straggling stores on. Where I grew up was too small to have that kind of video store. But when I went to college, I had that, the guy who has the one room in the back with all the really weird stuff. And if like you're brave enough to go back there, you're his best friend, because all he wants to do is talk about that weird crap that's in that room. And I don't know, it's an experience, because I don't know, because horror is something that it's just either you like it or you don't. When you find someone that's like just genuinely interested in it, it's like, oh my God, we have so many things, so many questions I want to ask you, because I think about this stuff all the time by myself, but I never get to ask anybody because nobody cares.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I have to say, being a younger kid at the tail end of the 70s, that was like a golden age for like big hardcover books full of like pictures of the old movies, with all this behind the scenes text and everything, which I've got a lot of those books on my shelf right behind my head here, because I've collected them off of eBay over the years. But they were in my elementary school library. And I would check them out over and over again and learn. So I was fascinated to learn about all these horror movies I hadn't seen. And then, like when I was in junior high, I got really into Stephen King, his early novels. And he had a book called Dance Macabre, which was a nonfiction book. And that was like a whole education as far as the history of horror before my time. And I just became obsessed. It's like, I just want to see all of it. I want to experience all of it. Even like, of the old 1940s horror radio shows. I've collected tapes and cassettes of those and CDs of those, which are just fun to listen to when I'm drawing. They just set the mood, you know? So it's like, I just want to know about all of it.
Well, and imagine that with another decade tacked on. That's kind of where I am in life. It's like, this, like for me, like the the thing that I want most is, like, I want to capture all those original EC comics and be able to flip through them. Probably never going to happen considering what the cost is to actually obtain one of them these days, if you can find anybody that has them.
Right. Well, the reprints are plentiful on those.
Yeah. But is a reprint really going to do it for me? I don't know.
Yeah. I've got a few of them. There was a phase of time where I was working in animation, doing really good, and I could, I was finally had a grown up job, and then I was like, I could afford it, and it was a time when there was no interest in pre-code horror comics. Like, I was going to conventions. This was before all the reprint books started coming out. And I was like reading about these things and seeing pictures of them, and I was going to the conventions, and the dealer booths would just have them for reasonable. I mean, they were more expensive than your usual comic, obviously, because they were old, but they weren't crazy priced like they are now, because there were no reprints, so nobody except weird horror movie, nobody except weird monster fans really knew they even existed, right? So I managed to, just with perfect timing, collect a bunch of old pre-code horror comics from going to the conventions year after year. And then all of a sudden, that's when the reprint books came out. Like, right when I felt like I had the ones I really wanted, the reprint books started coming out. And all of a sudden, everybody knew about them, and they just vanished from the conventions. I couldn't find them at all anymore.
Right on. Well, having talked about that, why don't you tell us a little bit about your big project? Well, what do you got going on now, and what that is?
As far as my campaign, yeah, okay. So I've got my comic book series. I'll show real quick. Issues 1 through 9, Wolf and Batsy, and I decided to do a crowdfunding campaign for issues 10, 11, and 12. That's number 4. So I decided to go with Fund My Comic. I was looking at Indiegogo, but I ultimately decided to go with Fund My Comic and launched the campaign for issues 10, 11, and 12. And it met its goal like within 2 days and a couple hours. I launched it on a Wednesday night at 8 o'clock, and it was fully funded by Saturday morning. So that's issues 1 through 9 that I just went through really quickly there. And here's a proof copy of issue 10 that I got from the printer, so you can see what it looks like. Got the cover without any text on the back. Interior artwork is black and white. Here's issue 11, proof copy. This is what you'll be getting if you order them, or pre-order them, I should say, on the campaign. So yeah, I mean, it's just pretty straightforward. It's a comic book series ongoing. As you said, it's very much in the style of the 1950s pre-code horror comics, or like, say, 1970s creepy and eerie magazine type stuff. And I did those first 9 issues through a publisher, and then decided to go back to self-publishing, which I'd done self-publishing before that for a long time. And after doing those 9 issues, I decided to go back to self-publishing and decided to just move forward with crowdfunding.
Out of curiosity, is there a reason you decided to make that choice? I mean, to me, most people are just chasing it the opposite direction. I'm doing the crowdfunding until I can get somebody to help me do this.
The less I say about that, the better. It was not a very happy or friendly separation.
Well, that's unfortunate.
And it would be, I'm aware that the publisher went out of his way to, I'm not the only book or creator that has left that company. And we all have our reasons, I'm aware that the public.
I don't know anything about this myself, so you can divulge as little as you want. I was just curious from, like you said, the standpoint of there are a lot of people that's what they fetishize over is, like, finding somebody who will publish their stuff.
Finding a publisher. Yeah, well, that was my idea for a long time, too. I was self-publishing. I created Wolf and Batsy in 1999, started drawing the comics in 2000, and just did it just sporadically on the side of my day job and family life. And I was pitching it to publishers, and for a while, it got picked up by this little publisher and then that little publisher, and they put out a couple issues, but some of these places had financial problems and ended up closing down, as a lot of small publishers tend to do. So finally I said, you know what, forget it. I'm just going to do it myself. So from 2008 all the way till 2017, I was self-publishing trade paperbacks of Wolf and Batsy stories. And in 2021, a publisher came along and wanted to put it out, basically reprinting the stories that were in the trade paperbacks. And I thought, wow, this is great. You know, that's great working with a publisher that's going to deal with the printer, deal with the, you know, the inventory, the distribution, fulfilling orders, the print, all that stuff. And the promotion, of course, the advertising. And I can take that burden off my shoulders and I can just focus on making the book, which sounded like a very ideal situation. And so that's the way it was for about 2 years. And it was a very happy situation. I thought, wow, this is great. This is the publisher I've been waiting for, you know, somebody who really gets it and wants to go the distance with it, because I have a lot of Wolf and Batsy material, a lot of backlog in those trade paperbacks I was self-publishing that I can just keep reprinting, or as well as making new stories. And then in the third year, the publisher launched his own book and immediately said, okay, I can't promote you guys anymore. I only have time to promote my own book. All the promotion is on you guys now.
That's a serious realigning of what we're supposed to be doing in this deal, basically.
Yeah. And I mean, I understand to a certain degree, I need to be out there pushing my book. That makes sense. You know, doing interviews and things like that. But you know, it was like to shove all of that on the individual creators. And it also came with a lot of like demands and guilt trips and nobody's doing enough. You guys aren't doing enough, blah, 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 blah. And it just doesn't come natural to everyone to put out a YouTube video every single day. And you know, not everybody got into comics to be a broadcaster. You know what I mean? And I felt like there was a real feeling of coming from this publisher of, you know, he's got his own book now. It's like, why does he need the rest of these guys? You know, it kind of felt like that. And it just got to be the kind of thing where it was like, well, good grief. Why should I share the profits with you? You know, I can deal with all the, if I got to the promotion part too, I can deal with fulfillment and shipping orders. I've done self-publishing before, so I know how to work with a printer. And so there were tensions there. And then of course it just, all it took was one stupid argument over nothing. Publisher had a little bit of a temper tantrum and finally just said, you know, it just got to be very just like, you know.
Things need to dissolve when they need to dissolve, so unfortunately.
Yeah, exactly. It was just like, it culminated in an argument over nothing, in my opinion. And then it was just like, you know what? Fine, get out of here. Like, you didn't, I was no longer, it was made clear that I was no longer welcome. And to me, it was just like, well, that's too bad that we couldn't just, you know, compromise.
Not to air dirty laundry, but I think it is definitely useful for people to know that, you know, if the publisher is your dream, it's maybe not always what you're looking for. And even when it is, it doesn't mean it's always going to be what you expect it to be. You know, things change, life changes. And I mean, the whole industry in the past 10 years and in the next 10 years, I'm sure it's going to change even more than it has and become more tumultuous. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the truth is, nobody's ever going to care about your book as much as you are. And nobody's ever going to handle it as well as you are. And, you know, there are going to be times when you're just, if you're working with a publisher, there are bound to be times when you're just bopping along, creating your comic or promoting your comic in whatever way feels natural to you. And out of nowhere, you get a very unhappy private message saying, I don't like the way you're doing this, or I do like the way you're doing that, but I don't like this, and change that, stop doing this, or do this different or whatever. And it's just like, why should that even make a difference?
Yeah. Well, and you know, even from my perspective, like when I'm a marketer and I'm talking to a client, or I'm talking to, you know, a prospective client about what they're doing, there's always this point where like my own ideas of like how we can sell this thing, how we can make people get interested and creep in, and they may not align necessarily with what the creator's vision of it is. It's like, because for me, it's like, I want you to be able to sell your comics. So how do I hack into what's already in people's brains? And then, and how do I make them want this thing? You know, is that always going to be the way that's going to be useful to you, as opposed to we're just trying to put these books in people's hands, you know. So
yeah, and when you're, like I said, having self-published for a long time before that, it's like, well, if you're not going to do the work of the publisher, then why should I share the profits with you? And the motivation to stay becomes less and less. And then, and like I said, all it takes is one argument over nothing. And then it's like, well, what's the point of this? It's really too bad. It's really too bad. Because my goal was to stick it out. And it's like, well, if I have to be a punching bag for a while, whatever, I can do that. I mean, I've worked in TV animation for 23 years. I've worked with producers. I've worked with directors. I've worked with other artists. I know how to be part of a creative team and compromise and negotiate. And strangely enough, I've worked with all kinds of egos and personalities. And I find that comic book publishers are harder, more impossible to compromise with than anyone. There's a very my way or the highway attitude behind the scenes.
Well, in this, and maybe I'm wrong, this is all you. Like, you create Wolf and Batsy, the whole thing. It's not like you're sending it off to a creator to be made, right? Or do you have, like, you have another artist? That's what I thought. So, I mean, this is like, at no point is this ever put into anybody's hands to help you create this vision. This is your vision, start to finish. And, you know, it's kind of like, well, it's almost like, why am I letting this one person in at the finish line? You know, I might as well handle the whole thing my own way if it's not going to, you know, be that.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like, you want to stick it out as long as you can for the readers and get as many issues out as you can. But there's a point, you know. There's a party that just goes, why am I putting up with that? So, not that normally I would not air dirty laundry either, but I understand the publisher's already gone out of his way to do that himself. So I guess, you know, it's too bad. Our last conversation ended with me saying, well, when this announcement comes out that I'm no longer with the company, can we just chalk it up to creative differences and leave it at that? And the publisher gave me a thumbs up, which I thought meant, okay, well, cool. And then he proceeded to not honor that agreement. So I guess, like I said, normally I would consider it unprofessional to air dirty laundry, but I guess the other side already has told their one-sided narrative spun version of it. I guess it's okay for me to say my piece.
So having, you know, dealt with all that, having self-published, obviously you're going to probably have a personal desire toward, or personal favoritism towards the self-publishing route, I would imagine. Okay. And I'm curious, what are the things that you have found the most difficult or the biggest hurdles in making that happen for yourself? Obviously, you've been in the industry and you've done it a few different times. Have things even changed as far as that question goes in the past 20 years?
As far as self-publishing, you mean? Well, it's the changes in technology are, you have to keep up with. It's funny, when I started self-publishing, that was right around the time the first few print-on-demand comic book printing companies started popping up online. And at first, they didn't exactly have their materials figured out yet. I think a lot of us who were early adopters of those services were kind of like their guinea pigs. Because the first couple batches of books I self-published through them were not the greatest quality, took a few rounds before I think they figured out how to do it best, and eventually we got to a place where they were nice products, but that took some getting used to, and that's very frustrating when you spend a certain amount of money, and then the books come back and they're just not, you know, the printing is bad or whatever. It just, that just breaks your heart, you know. It's, there's always a scary feeling when you get that box in the mail of the copies that you, from the printer, and you opened up to see how they turned out. And
what's going to be wrong with this?
Yeah, what's going to be wrong with it? You know, what tiny minute thing is going to be wrong with it that I'm going to have to look at for the rest of my life? It's going to drive me crazy, but it's not worth redoing the whole print run over. There's things like that. So, you know, that's a challenge, but that has gotten better and better and easier to navigate. And of course, there's the experience of just doing it over and over again. You know, you get the hang of it and you kind of understand what they're asking for when you fill out that form with all the different paper stocks and things like that. And you know how much to order and things like that. For this time around, the challenge was just learning the ropes of the crowdfunding campaign website. I'd never done an Indiegogo or crowdfunding thing by myself before. I'd always been part of a team that where the publisher basically set it up. So it was a little bit of a learning curve there to, and I looked at Indiegogo first, and there were aspects of the way that one was set up that were a little bit confusing to me at first, having never done it before.
I remember an Indiegogo not liking it very much.
Okay, well, yeah. And also, their customer service just seemed to struck me as non-existent. I mean, I would get stuck on a technical part and send them a question. I'd never hear anything back. And then everyone I knew kept recommending Fund My Comic.
Well, the big difference, obviously, is that Luke is a guy who cares deeply about this stuff. My bigger fear with Indiegogo is always the politics of the company itself, which have all too often interjected themselves into the material that they're willing to push or allow, like people getting shadow banned and things like that.
Yeah, and that's, I haven't even entered into that minefield yet. I don't even know about that yet.
I don't know that you would, honestly. I don't know your politics, and it's probably for the better. I don't know why we need to know each other's politics. You make a cool horror comic, can't we just leave it at that?
Yeah, that's pretty much all I care about is telling monster stories and drawing monsters. So there was a learning curve with figuring out the crowdfunding website, but like you said, Luke is right there. He answers direct messages very quickly, and they have great tutorial videos that help you walk through it and figure it out. So, but also I felt like just the setup, even before I got to my questions, was much more straightforward and user-friendly. So there was a learning curve there, but it was all right. I suppose the next big hurdle will be when the campaign wraps up and I have to do fulfillment. That'll be a new experience, but I'm already setting up for that. I've already been bagging and boarding issues and signing things and getting ready. So hopefully, take some of that.
I'm curious, how many custom covers have you had to do yet?
Custom covers? Oh, you mean like the sketch covers?
yeah, the perk cover.
Oh yeah. I'll just show that off real quick. So that's one of the perks I offer on the campaign, these blank variant sketch covers. You order one of those, and I will do an original drawing.
I tried to get the wife to let me.
A one-of-a-kind. Yeah. A one-of-a-kind Wolf and Batsy sketch just for you, and it's on issue 7. That's one of the perks on the campaign.
I am curious as a fan as to why you chose issue 7.
I didn't. The publisher chose that. That was when I was still with the publisher. Issue 7 was kind of a fan favorite issue. It was, if I can find it in my little stack of books here, it was an issue called The Gorilla Suit Maniac.
Okay, I gotcha.
Long story behind that one, but basically Wolf and Batsy end up battling a guy in a gorilla suit who is also an axe murderer.
It's a fun book.
Yeah.
Well, it's fun because it certainly breaks the narrative that you've had going for the first couple issues and gives you something different.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was the idea, too, was to throw some one-shot, single-issue stories into the mix to sort of break up that ongoing narrative. So I guess maybe because that issue was well-liked, or maybe just because it was the right time, that was the one that was chosen to be a sketch cover. No other real reason behind it. But, yeah, I think I offered 15 of those on the campaign. And I think so far 5 of them have.
Well, I'm glad. Like I said, I tried to talk the wife into it, and she's all like, your kid's birthday. And I'm like, okay, we'll take care of the kid, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Fine.
I know about that.
If I didn't do that, I was going to have to cut into the rest of my comic book budget for the month.
Oh, man.
Sorry, Brian.
That's all right.
So we've kind of reached the end here. I'm sure I couldn't talk to you forever about all this stuff because it's super interesting to me, and meeting someone that I actually have a combined interest with is always fun. What would you like to leave people with? If there's like one thing, one recommendation for someone who's, you know, new to being a creative and, you know, trying to get out there and do their thing, what would be like your one word of advice?
My word of advice would be, if you want to create a comic book of your own, I would say the first thing is to come up with some characters that you know you will never get bored of in a million years. For me personally, that was a werewolf and a vampire. I can think of a million stories about werewolves and vampires, and if they're running around together as friends, that's even better. I'll never get bored of that concept. I'd say come up with characters that you know you'll never get bored of, and then before giving into the temptation to jump into a big, long, epic story about them, I would suggest just do a little short 10-page story about them. Take them for a test drive and see if you really like them. At the end of those 10 pages, you'll know if you want to stop, if this is not for you, or if you want to keep doing more.
Right on. And where can we send people to learn more about you, or even better, to pick up their own copies of Wolf and Batsy?
I have a website, brianbaugh.net, BRYANBAUGH.net, all as one word. It has a store page. And on that store page, you can order the first 9 issues, the back issues I just showed. There are a couple of sketch covers on there as well. And then the current campaign, if you want to pre-order issues 10, 11, and 12, is on Fund My Comic under Wolf and Bats.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this with us today. And you have a good one.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Do you fancy yourself the next Tolkien, Lewis, or Barker? Maybe you just have something subversive to say. Hopefully this podcast is helping you. But maybe your ambitions are just a little bigger than you can handle on your own. Head over to ironagemarketing.com and let Nikki P. help ensure your book doesn't release to nobody.